Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. Get ready. Saturday, August 6th is Mead Day. In celebration of this sweet homebrew holiday, the American Homebrewers Association is offering listeners $5 off membership with promo code MEADDAY22. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to download a variety of mead recipes, find a homebrew supply shop, and dust off your mead-making skills with how-to videos. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to get $5 off for Mead Day when you join or renew by August 8th, 2022. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, June 30th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about homebrewing. This week, we're back from HomebrewCon in Pittsburgh with a ton of stuff for you to listen to. This week, we start with interviews from day one of the conference. We'll talk about mystery yeast found in an old fermenter in an abandoned tunnel, floor malting in an old elementary school, a delicious Carolina Reaper beer, and an award-winning Tej maker about going pro. And we'll talk to Julia Herz about her first HomebrewCon as executive director of the AHA, and much more. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. It's thanks to our financial supporters and our sponsors, of course, that we were able to go to HomebrewCon. We've got five episodes worth of content, so it was well worth the investment. And it was awesome seeing lots of listeners in person and talking to y'all, getting pictures taken and all that fun stuff. And speaking of listeners, I want to thank everybody who went to Desiree and Dave's HighGravityBrew.com booth on the trade floor to thank them for sponsoring the show. We got to spend a lot of time with Desiree and Dave, along with our buddy Zod O'Connor. It was definitely a highlight of the trip. Desiree said a bunch of people mentioned the podcast to them at the High Gravity booth and thanked them for sponsoring the show. I had to fess up to her that I did ask a couple of listeners to do that myself. But Desiree said that there were many more than just a couple. So, again, I appreciate you all doing that, and I hope that you're supporting Desiree and Dave at HighGravityBrew.com as well. You know, Desiree and Dave had on display on the trade floor their Warthog electric brewing controllers that'll help you take the pain out of propane, including the EBC-130 that I have. Dave builds those himself in the back of High Gravity in Tulsa. High Gravity was putting together electric systems before electric brewing was cool. I mean, hot. They have several turnkey configurations on HighGravityBrew.com, and they can customize one to fit your needs. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your Warthog electric brewing purchase, whether you want a whole system or just a controller. That's at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Show Desiree and Dave some love and some support. It was great being able to wander around at HomebrewCon, interviewing random folks and discovering amazing beers and stories. Now, what you're about to hear is all of the interviews that we did on day one of the conference in order and pretty much unedited. And for journalists like Steve and me, the conference is a gold mine. Everybody that you talk to has a story, and every beer is fun to talk about and fun to taste. So we started with the first beer at the club booth in the center of the trade floor.
Why don't we have a boom microphone? That's what I want to know.
That costs money. Steve, we're here at the, the hospitality booth?
Yeah.
We're at HomebrewCon in Pittsburgh. This is our first beer.
It's the best one I've had all day.
And who are we talking to?
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm one of the members of the Badass Beer Club, brewers and drinkers around Silver Spring.
In Silver Springs, Maryland?
Maryland, yeah, right outside D.C.
Awesome. And what are we drinking here?
So this is a mild ESB, something along those lines. I brewed up about a month ago.
What do you think, Steve?
It's very tasty, and I understand you grew the hops for this.
Yeah, I got some hop vines or whatever. A couple years ago from a friend, they've been going in the backyard just as they go. So they started producing about 2 years ago. So I froze them from last year and the year before and threw them in this beer and was going to see how it worked.
It's delicious. So what's the environment in Maryland for growing hops? It's a little too hot in Arkansas, where we're from.
Oh, yes. We are probably right on the border of, like, acceptable hop growing, where I wouldn't recommend a huge large scale. But we do have a couple breweries that do grow hops. They do throw it in there, but it's like a seasonal one-off beer situation. They're not really large operations.
Now, tell me about this beer. What's the grain bill? And you fermented with this. This is not an English yeast.
Oh, no, not at all. I wanted to get this done quick, so I threw in one of the Omega Glycis. I cannot tell you what variety it was, but they're here today somewhere. They might be able to. They're actually right behind us. They might be able to taste it and tell you. But did that, and then I did a 3-gallon batch with 5 pounds of 2-row. Just basic pale 2-row, and then a pound of caramel malt. It's a little heavy on that, but it worked out pretty well.
I don't think it's heavy.
Yeah. It's not heavy for the style.
Yeah,
it's nice and it's not. You say heavy, but it's not. It's nice and dry. It's nice and crisp. It's got a little bit of citrusy fruitiness. Do you think that's the hops or the yeast?
That's probably the yeast. I have Glacier hops, which are apparently, like, very mild, just a kind of basic bittering hop. I don't really know what they taste like in a beer quite yet from my own plants. So, because I need a lot more than, I think I had 3 ounces that I had. So, what I kept reading online was you gotta have, like, double the amount of volume compared to a pellet hop to get the same effect from a full hop. And I had about the same, so... you're not getting a ton of hop flavor, but it works for the style. It just gets it bitter enough. Works well with everything, apparently. I'm glad it worked. So,
good job.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. I think we have a couple other things here, too, that we're getting set up. They'll be ready by the time we're done talking, I'm pretty sure. We're really hoping.
All right.
Looks like they're figuring it out. So,
thanks for the beer and congratulations.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have fun.
Okay, it's our second beer of the day. I'm going to have to stop saying that because, you know, then people will know how many beers we had.
Well, I can't do that much math.
Yeah, it gets harder as we go along.
It gets harder as we go.
So Joe's getting a sample of his beer. Now, tell me who you are and where you're from.
Sure. My name is Joe Rafferty with the Malt Homebrew Club from Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Wow. So we're from Arkansas, so okay. Sort of. And Steve said, "Don't mention the baseball game."
Oh, yeah. Okay, that was what was it? 9-1.
I don't remember.
It was a whooping.
Like, yeah, we got spanked the day after or something. So, yeah. But on to happier things. What kind of beer do we have here?
This is a Munich Kellis. Made that probably 3 or 4 months ago. It's been just kind of lagering away, waiting on the event here. So, obviously, majority Pils malt. Got a little bit of Munich, a slight touch of Millennoiden. I did not do a decoction or anything, so I just added a small percentage of that. And then just WLP 830, so German lager yeast. And extra love and care and attention and time, and here we are.
Here we are.
So you're a brewer in the South, like us. Did you have some mechanical help with your lagering?
Yeah, I've got a big stainless conical that I put in an upright freezer with a temperature controller on it, so it's kind of cheating as far as homebrew goes.
I was going to accuse you of that, but no swamp coolers, no T-shirts, and a bucket of water and all that stuff.
No, I don't. I thankfully don't have to get too creative. I just pump it right in there from the system and let it rock.
Well, it's a super clean beer.
It's very, very nice. A great example of the style. Everything's balanced and tastes terrific.
So what are your secrets to a nice, clean, fermented lager?
I take a lot of measure for yeast health. You know, I'm big on pitching appropriate rates. I'm big on very strict temperature control. I don't really do any finings or anything. I just let time do its thing, and seems to work pretty well. But I really focus on good ingredients, healthy pitches, tight temperature control. Thankfully, live in White Lab, one of their backyards, so we get good fresh samples from them. So shout out to White Labs. They're really good to our club here. We have every other month we get to meet in one of their spaces. So they've always been great to us, as well as Sierra Nevada. Even they've got a room that we get to use. So shout out to both of them. They're a big help for our club, for sure.
Yeah, it turns out North Carolina is a good beer state.
Absolutely, yeah. We're lucky. I moved to Asheville right at 14 years ago and have seen a really nice boom. I thought it was, you know, one of the Beer City USAs when I moved there, and, you know, we've probably multiplied fivefold since then. So it's been fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
You did a great job.
I appreciate it. Y'all come back. Plenty more.
Thanks. So tell me who you are and where you're from.
Brendan Carroll with the CNC Malting Company. We're here in Pittsburgh now at the Homebrew Convention, and we're located about an hour north of here between the towns of Butler and Katanning, so kind of west central PA. An hour off the highway there is 420, excuse me, half mile off the highway there, it's 422. We were talking earlier about the barley harvest. It's coming off now here in Pennsylvania, so exciting times. We've got about 54 acres off already, about another 100 or so, 150 to go. And so far it's looking good, about 70 bushel to 80 bushel an acre. Nice barley, dried down nice for us, so a real good year harvest-wise in Pennsylvania. So we're happy for that. Hopefully we can make up for some of the shortcomings in the rest of the world. Yeah, we were talking a little about our malt house, so I guess we could jump back into that. It's an old elementary school, about 30,000 square foot. Everything we do is floor malted, and so we go with a turner that we built, a beautiful little stainless rototiller kind of machine, and that turns it about 3-4 times a day. We drag it through the malt. That keeps it aerated, keeps it cool, and keeps it from clumping up. Sometimes clumping's okay, like in the Munich malt. If you want to try that Munich, we allow that to clump at the end. But other than that, we keep it turned, keep it aerated. Then we kiln it out and make a lot of very nice traditional floor malts. We've been told that we're more Maris Otter than Maris Otter.
Which, oh, really? Really?
Yeah. And so Maris Otter is actually a variety, and a lot of people kind of use that as a misnomer for pale ale type malt is what comes to mind. We've worked with some varieties that are in the Maris Otter family. Most of the malts we work with, the barleys, excuse me, that we work with are of European descent. So from Lima grains, we do Calypso, Violetta. We work with TP. So it works out very well for us being kind of a more humid climate. We don't run into pre-sprout issues, and they're a little more... what's the word? Resistant to vomitoxin and DON, so we don't have issues with the fusariums, the fungus that causes those. So we don't have issues with those. We spray to keep that in a manageable level, but we're growing some great barley here and making some great malt.
Steve, you had a little issue with vomitoxin last HomebrewCon, I think.
Well, that was later in the week, yeah.
just a joke.
But you said you had so many acres coming off. Do you grow your own do you have your own farms?
No, so we contract with our neighbors. Farms are typically, most of our acreage is about 2 miles from the malt house. We do stretch out maybe to about 30 miles or so. And so pretty much we work with the farmers to grow, what varieties to grow, what to spray with. So it's a partnership. Turning the malt 4 or 5 times a day takes up most of my day. So it'd be hard to get out and spray as well. So
does your size allow you to be kind of nimble in trying new, different malt techniques and different styles that other people, larger companies may not?
Yes, sir. I guess the audience can't see me nodding my head, but yes. So we started off just doing 200 pounds in a batch. So figure worst case you mix that up, we feed it to the chickens. So we keep chickens for just that reason. But so there's a lot of times we'll have requests for the next thing we're doing is an under modified pilsner. So that's not something everyone wants. We'll do a small run of that, see if it's makes the brewer happy. If he's happy, then we'll do a large production run. So in our production run is roughly 4 tons per batch. So even that's not a huge amount. If the kind of whims of the industry change, we could change with it.
Do you do any smoking?
We do. So on the table, the first one up is a pear-smoked wheat malt, and we did that very heavily smoked. So our smoker's really this neat thing. I wish we could show you the video, show your audience the video. It looked like a witch's brew. So it's a big old industrial popcorn maker. We put a wedge wire false bottom in and put our firebox about 10 feet away so we get more of a cool smoke to the malt. And this one, we built up a bigger fire, got some heat to it, gave some local caramelization so you get some sweetness in there with the smoky. We just got back from Scotland a week ago today, and we brought some peat back with us, so we'll be doing some peat smoked as well. For the most part, we're smoking over fruit wood, so apple's my favorite. People ask for oak, we do peach, we're going to do cherry next. As I mentioned, that's pear. Apple's really nice. We like to think that our apple tree was planted by Johnny Appleseed. We're in the right neighborhood. It's an old tree. I can't confirm or deny that, but it's a good story.
Well, what I've got to know is, what was it like getting peat back through customs?
It was surprisingly easy. My wife thought the same thing. She said, you're not going to get through with that. And I looked it up, and soil is absolutely positively not allowed. That's what peat is. But the first thing on the exemption list is peat. And if you think about it, they're cutting it, then they're drying in it, high temperatures. So that kills everything. Yeah, so yeah. We're not cross-infecting our continents here. So basically it was about 20 kilograms, so we stuck a baggage label on it and hoped that it stayed. It fell off when we got it in Washington, but then we went and the lady was nice enough to print me another baggage label, so we stuck it on and got it back through. So it's pretty easy. If you're traveling to Scotland, leave yourself one bag for the return. You can take some peat back with you and smoke yourself.
I was just imagining the conversation. Do you have anything to declare, sir? Well, yes, I've got some peat.
So how do homebrewers out there listening find you?
On our website, cncmalt.com, or if they're in the neighborhood, they could stop out the malt house and pay us a visit. We're out 719 Clearfield Road, Fenelton, PA. Or the best method's the telephone, so 570-954-4500. Give us a shout and we'll get you set up.
Thanks, Brendan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Enjoy your beer.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you, too.
You probably already know that Ricky and Kelly from our friends and sponsors Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont post homebrew-scale recipes of some of their delicious craft meads and a vlog, or blog, not a vlog. Well, they did have a vlog there for a while with valuable mead-making info. Well, Ricky, the mead maker, has been posting his weekly brew journal on Groenfell.com recently that gives you a day-to-day look behind the scenes of a commercial meadery. For example, taking a look at this past week's journal, 6-20-22, reprogrammed the keg cleaner and it's working fantastically. Blew a line and overfilled the sani tank, but those are minor hiccups. Plus, the floor near the loading dock hasn't been this clean, let alone sanitized, in years. 6-21-22, Braggy is done. I love this batch so much. Jake was totally right that one more pound of elderflower would make all the difference. And 6-22-22, just packing boxes and prepping for Ren Fair. So that's life. A day in the life of a meadery. So if you want to find that, you know, it's great if you're starting a brewery or thinking of starting a brewery or a meadery, you can search for Ricky's Brew Journal on Groenfell.com to get a peek behind the scenes of day-to-day life in that profession. And while you're on Groenfell.com, check out the wide range of delicious craft meads and honey beverages that they're shipping right now across the country. Always something new and tasty at our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies. Check it all out at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's GroenFell.
All right, tell me who you are and where you're from.
I'm Mike Jewell from Silver Spring, Maryland.
And what's your club?
Badass.
And joining us is Zod O'Connor.
Howdy.
Regular of the podcast. Now, I'm sipping on a beer that I was scared of the title. And when I got my first sample, it was just a little squirt because I didn't want to burn my taste buds off. What do we got here?
So this is Viking Pilsner malt with sucrose. And then I have all the different pumpkin pie spices added to it. And for a 15-gallon batch, I added in primary 6 cut-in-half Carolina Reaper peppers.
Now, for those of you not familiar with the Carolina Reaper, it's either the ugliest pepper or a beautiful pepper, depending on what you think. It's kind of a red, scary, wrinkly-looking pepper, right?
Yeah, and it's got like a scorpion stinger tail on the tip of it.
And what's the Scoville level? Do you remember?
So it's a range, but they can go up to 2 million.
A friend of mine grew these at one point, and I've said on the show before, but I tasted a piece of the de-seeded flesh that was about half the size of my pinky nail, and it tasted delicious at first, and then the top of my head started sweating, and it, you know, worked its way down my face, and you know, my heart started beating faster, you know, so it is something to deal with. But this beer, I was afraid that it was going to blow my head off, but it's actually got a really nice flavor, and the heat is there, but it's a lot more reserved than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's about as hot as is still enjoyable.
What do you think, Zod?
I agree. The foam was very dangerous. Steve did not take well to the foam earlier. But the finish, it's not in the mouth. It's only in the finish, which is kind of amazing. Do you attribute that to the spices or the I mean, it sounds like a very thin beer to begin with.
It is, and I use Hornendahl Quake is the yeast I use. So, I mean, it was super underpitched and not terribly warm when I pitched it. So it's pretty clean. But yeah, and I just used a little bit. Like, I've made habanero beers. I made a Buchalokia beer one time. I've done a bunch of jalapeno beers. So I'm good at kind of where to add the peppers and how many. So I kind of, you know, 6 of these cut in half in primary for probably 3 or 4 weeks was what I decided on.
So, seeds in?
Yeah, seeds in. Even the stems were still attached.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, James has been on the tincture track for a while, which, you know, about 2 years behind me on that one. And I think that's the right way to go when you're trying to figure out how to balance it. How did you figure out how to balance how many peppers to put in? Because that's a risk. So, I mean, if they were all hot, you just ruined 15 gallons of beer.
Well, I have a pretty high heat tolerance, so I was willing to drink all of it no matter how it turned out. I had an oyster dunkel vice that didn't go too well. And I drank, actually, I'm still working on that. It's been about a year and a half. I'm trying to slowly, you know, but however it turned out, I was going to drink it. I can eat a whole Carolina Reaper. At one time on Instagram, I ate 2, which I'll never do ever again. But I mean, I can have a high tolerance. So I knew it was not going to be ruined for me. And I have made Buchalokia beer, so I kind of treated the Carolina Reaper the same way I treated the Buchalokia, and it worked out pretty well.
I'm not going to ask you how your day was after that experience, or the day after.
Yeah, it was about a rough 18 hours.
I won't ask you why, but you also talked about pumpkin spice in this beer, right?
Yeah.
So for those who always, you know, have wonderful things to say about pumpkin spice, I didn't, when I first tasted the beer, I only tasted a small sample, I didn't notice the pumpkin spice so much. It kind of blends in with the rest of it, and it actually is not a pumpkin spice forward beer, would you say? I mean, I think it seems to me that you mastered the balance of that pretty well.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's usually when I make a pumpkin ale, I put the same amount of pumpkin spice in as I do when I make a pumpkin ale. And then I just added the Reapers on top of it, which kind of just take all the focus away from the pumpkin spice.
Yeah. I didn't know there was any pumpkin spice in it, but it definitely has a mouthfeel much more than just, you said you put Victory Malt in?
No, it's a Viking Pilsner. It's all Pilsner.
With sucrose, right?
With sucrose.
I'm not a fan of Pilsner malt as a base beer, typically. And I would have said, oh, that's going to be thin if you told me. And I think the spice is what kept that. Like, I did not detect anything wrong with the mouthfeel. And it didn't taste like a pepper beer going in or chili beer going in. It definitely, you know, your throat has this nice, wonderful burn to it.
Yep. Yeah, actually, this sample, it is starting to build up, but not any incredible. I think if I drank a whole pint of it, I would be feeling it by the end. And now I am getting more cinnamon. It's mostly cinnamon to me. Yeah. Maybe a little bit of clove. But again, it's not overpowering. It's not something like people would make fun of.
Well, cool. That's good to hear. I was worried, you know, with this crowd. Like, I made it more for, like, my friends that are maybe not so much in the brewing community. Like, if I brought it to one of our meetings, I would kind of think people would be like, oh, no, this is too much. But, yeah, it's good to hear. I'm glad it's not novelty crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing about this conference is that you do get to try a lot of things that, oh, that was fun for an ounce, but I don't know if I'd drink a whole pint. I would drink a pint of this. I might regret it the next day, but sure.
Cool. That's good to hear.
I think you underestimated your audience. You should put a big bumper sticker up there with the exclamation points and say Carolina Reaper, and we go in an hour here. This is the conference for people who go like, Carolina Reaper beer? I want that right now.
Okay, now introduce your girlfriend.
This is my girlfriend, Katie Egan. She inspired the beer.
the person, there's the face that launched a thousand ships, and there's the person that launched a spicy beer.
I would say the person who burned your esophagus. To be honest, we had made holiday cookies, and I was saying that I wanted a spicy gingerbread cookie, and then we started talking about beer, because we talk about beer a lot. And so Mike grows peppers all the time, and he was like, what if we made a Reaper gingerbread cookie beer? And this is what came out of that. So
what do you think?
I love it, but don't drink too much of it, because you'll wake up on the bathroom floor and you won't know how you got there.
So Tuesday.
Exactly.
Just a Tuesday.
We have to remind ourselves to pour it in small glasses, otherwise we'll like pour a whole pint of it and then be like, how did we get here?
So it's like that episode of The Simpsons where Homer coats his throat with wax and drinks or eats that pepper and has the hallucinogenic experience.
Exactly. It's not quite that good, but it is really good. And my favorite thing about this beer actually is that some spicy beers are really like hit your lips and your lips start tingling. This has none of that. It, like, even if you don't really love spicy things, this could be a beer that you'd be willing to try, because it's all in that, I think you mentioned, is that the after, it's in the swallow, right? You get the real spicy kick and the heat of it. So, I mean, that makes it drinkable for me. So I'm glad you enjoyed drinking it, too.
Yeah. I might get another one.
Actually, it does bring it. First off, that's exactly right. It does not hurt my lips, and I have chapped lips all the time. What was the ABV of it? I don't think you said so.
It's a little over 9.
What?
Yeah,
what?
It's imperial.
I figured out why you're waking up on the bathroom floor.
Yeah, that explains a lot. Okay. But I would not have guessed that. Wow. Again, excellent job.
Oh, thank you very much.
And you too.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Tell me who you are and where you're from.
My name's Rob Westendorf. I'm with the Blotarian Brewing League from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay. Wow. How far is Cincinnati away from here?
It was about a 4.5-hour drive, so it's 240 miles or so.
Not as far as I thought. My geography is not so great. So what are we about to sample here?
Okay, so this beer is a Baltic porter made with an experimental yeast. The yeast is called Missing Link. It was found in fermenters that had been hidden behind a brick wall of a brewery that closed in Cincinnati more than 100 years ago. It was the Link Brewery, hence the Missing Link on the yeast. So a brewery owner in Cincinnati for the Urban Artifact Brewery, who's a biochemist and yeast specialist by trade, took about 100 samples out of the room. One of them was positive for yeast, grew it up with the help of Omega, and they're starting to characterize this and hopefully eventually commercialize this yeast. So we really don't know what it is, because it ferments slow as an ale. It ferments fast as a lager. It doesn't dry as an ale. It goes dry as a lager. Last month we had a competition in Cincinnati for people just using this yeast, where everybody was encouraged, just try it. We're just trying to learn what it does. So I think there were 9 commercial beers and 27 homebrews of various types, ranging from Baltic Porter to Wit to Classic American Pilsners to I think there was a Schwartz beer, all just trying to find out what it does.
Well, that's fun. This is a delicious beer, but you didn't make it.
My wife made that beer.
And your wife's name is?
Roxanne Westendorf, who is also on the governing committee of the AHA.
So credit where credit is due.
Yes. And besides that, we've got a wit here that she also made with the same yeast. And tomorrow at club night, we'll have a couple other beers made with that yeast.
What do you think, Steve?
It's a good beer, and I'm curious if there was any conclusions from all the test brews.
I don't think everything has been concluded yet. The day of the competition, I wasn't able to be there, so I didn't participate in it. I know they've collected everything, and they're crunching the numbers, but I don't know where it stands yet. The competition really wasn't that long ago.
So any idea of the alcohol tolerance or, some of the characteristics?
Nobody has had it stall out on high alcohol, but I don't know if anybody's tried anything above about 9% yet. But so, I think, up to 9%, it seems to be fine.
So what are the chances that this is just, some wild yeast that just happened to be in the brewery, or are people pretty confident that this was a commercially used beer yeast?
We're not confident at all. literally, it's the fermenter was sealed up for, nobody looked at it for 100 years. They took samples from inside the fermenters all over the room. One came positive. It could be anything. The story's great. We don't know if it was the brewery's yeast or not, but it's making good beer.
So this is Geraldo Rivera's Al Capone's vault with something actually in it.
Yes, right. It's amazing how you can, go scrape some yeast off of an old fermenter or a piece of wild fruit or whatever, and it's like, holy crap, good stuff.
And it seems like it got to work right away. I mean, it seems like it's adapted to fermenting.
Yeah, it definitely, and it's unusual in fermenting because it can be very clean, fresh, but it ages more like a Belgian. So like in our competition, we had separate flights for fresh and aged beers, where aged had to be a year or more old. So the aged winner, which was also my wife, was an 18-month-old Orval clone. And I would say the way it aged, it kind of developed over 18 months about the same character Orval does in about 3 or 4 months. So it's slower than a standard Brett, but it's got some of that same character.
Yeah, this is a fairly clean fermented beer. There's no, certainly no Brett character that I can pick up.
That I think that's about 6 weeks old.
Well, that's interesting. Does temperature seem to have a difference? Or you said it fermented different as ales and lager.
Yeah, she fermented that, I believe, at 60. It comes out fairly clean. Most of the people who fermented up in the upper 60s found they had to co-pitch something else to get it to finish out.
Huh. That's interesting. That's counterintuitive.
We don't get one.
Steve is shrugging. Well, this is delicious, and congratulations to your wife. And this is a fun experiment. It'd be fun. It'd be fun to see some results down the line. I'll sort of interpret it.
I believe that they're going to have the Missing Link competition again next year, and try to expand the. the range of what everybody's going to do, and hopefully it goes beyond just Cincinnati. It's kind of up to Omega at this point as to whether they determine whether they're going to really commercialize it or not. But for the competition, at least, they gave away the yeast. We're literally throwing yeast packets at, you know, you get a yeast and you get a yeast. And, you know, go out.
It's the Oprah strain.
Yes, exactly. You know, go forth and ferment.
I'm curious about the brewery itself. So it was Cincinnati. It sounds like it could have been a German-American-German-style brewery.
So most people nowadays think of German beers in America as being Milwaukee or St. Louis. Before Prohibition, Cincinnati had more than twice as many breweries as those two places combined. You know, at one point, there were 79 breweries inside of a four-square-mile downtown Cincinnati. And they weren't sending any of it out of town because Cincinnati is so German, they were consuming it all.
This is fascinating and delicious.
Thanks.
All right, tell me who you are and where you're from.
Brett Coleman Baker from Urban Artifact in Cincinnati, Ohio.
And we just recently talked to Rob over here about the Missing Link yeast. So tell us about how your involvement in this project.
So I'm the owner and brewer, head brewer, whatever you want to call it, over at Urban Artifact. And there is a beer historian in Cincinnati named Michael Morgan, who teaches a class at the University of Cincinnati about beer history, or beer 101, basically. So he's been coming to breweries once a quarter. He brings his classes by, and he goes to four breweries a quarter. And he asked us if he could come to our brewery as the fourth brewery, because we only make sour beer. So the first three breweries were like, here's how it's done traditionally. Here's the brewery that throws all the rules out the window. So I got to know him pretty well. And over time, he found a lagering tunnel underneath Cincinnati in the OTR district. And he comes to me and he goes, hey, I know this is going to sound crazy, but in a lagering tunnel that's been sealed up for 100 years, I found a wood fermenter that's still intact. And I know that you found some wild yeast before and you've isolated some stuff. Can you come and try to see if you can find a yeast? I said, I don't think we're going to find but I think that sounds like a lot of fun. So let's see what happens. And, that's the short of it.
So how many samples did you take?
We took 100 samples. 90 were total just 10 were like fermented a little bit of varying degrees of flavor and goodness. So we sent those 10 away to Omega Yeast Labs to get isolated and plated out and look for yeast. They found four yeasts. One was Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So out of 100 samples, one was a brewing yeast.
Wow.
Literally a 1% success rate.
So how confident, I asked Rob, how confident are you that that was a yeast that was actually used for brewing? Or, you know, is it just accidental that this was a wild yeast that was found in place?
There's definitely a chance it's a wild yeast that just found its way into things. I think the fun thing is like, oh, this is a pre-pro yeast that was actually used by this brewery and it was in the thing and blah, blah, blah. The chances of that are really low. What we actually think the case probably is that during Prohibition, when these tunnels were supposed to be sealed up and not being used, what we're guessing is that there was a, you know, an alcohol runner under there making illegal booze, probably using a bread yeast because it doesn't attenuate very well and it doesn't have a lot of traditional beer flavors to it. So we're thinking it's probably a bread yeast that was used to make illicit alcohol during Prohibition. That would be my odds on money. Could be a wild yeast. Could actually be a legitimate German yeast brought over, you know, pre-pro, but it's hard to say. We sequenced the genome and it doesn't match anything that currently exists.
Yeah, that was my next question. Because you take the DNA signature.
We did, yep.
So, I mean, it's a fun story, number one.
It is.
Which is excellent for marketing.
Yes, but yes. Which is important.
Yeah, but apparently, you know, people are brewing with it and finding it doing all kinds of different things and all kinds of different beers. So, you know, that's exciting as well.
Well, okay, so we got this yeast. We gave it to the city. The city officially made June 4th Missing Link Day as part of, like, an official decree. And what we've really been proud and happy of is the homebrewers that have taken it and owned it and done all these things and are figuring out how it works and what tastes well and what doesn't. And, you know, I make one batch a year. I don't get to have that much fun with it. And I got to make sure it sells. The, you know, if you're homebrewing, you can make 10, 20, 30 batches if you split it out and have fun with it. And that's what the Bloatitarians in Cincinnati did. And, you know, we had 40 entries in our homebrew club this year. It was awesome. It's really cool to see the beers people are making with this that I don't get the chance to do because I financially can't take the risk.
Tell us about your brewery.
We are a fruit sour beer only brewery in Cincinnati, Ohio. We have a very defined niche and we're doing really well with it. And I just love fruit. That's it.
And your name is Brett.
So. Yes. You know, funnily enough, we started off doing the breadth of sour beer when we started. Like we did, you know, Brett beers, we did wild beers, we did spontaneous beers, we did fruited sours. And over time, we realized people don't really buy Brett beers that much and we don't make them anymore. So my own namesake is garbage.
You're too horsey.
Smell like
Well, excellent. Thanks for sharing the story.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate your time.
We got to record an episode with Dr. Matt Winans, head of R&D at our friends and sponsors, Imperial Organic Yeast. We talked to Dr. Matt about making sake at home, because he did a session on that, and about the new hybrid yeast strain from Imperial I-22 Capri. Matt walked us through the process of getting Juice, which is an English yeast strain, and Loki, a Kvike strain, to reproduce together to form a brand new strain. It's a complicated process, and he went through all the details. That's coming up in a future episode. I brewed a no-boil extract beer with I-22 Capri and Zamba hops. Steve also made a mead. And I had Susan taste the hydrometer sample of my Capri beer, and she said, pineapple. Now, I tasted tropical fruit, too, and a very teeny tiny bit of banana. But, after kegging, I decided to dry hop in the keg to bring up the hop character a bit more with some random hop remains that I had in the freezer. And I don't know how it's tasting yet because the hop bag immediately sank to the bottom and clogged the dip tube. So I've got some surgery to do there. So that story is still evolving. You know we love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore to make moderate gravity 5-gallon batches, and my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial I-22 Capri, the new hybrid yeast strain from Imperial, and find out more at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Tell me who you are and where you're from.
Hello, my name is LaVon Barker. I live in Miami Beach, but I also have a place in Chicago, Illinois.
And you were starting a story and telling Steve and me this story, and I said, no, wait a minute, we got to capture this because this is good stuff. So start all over again, your story with Tej.
Yes, I make a Ethiopian Tej home brew. I started making it in 2016. And the reason is, inside Ethiopia, there's a high mortality rate. A lot of kids don't make it to 1 year old. So when a kid does make it to 1 year old, they have a birthday celebration. It is a very large celebration. A lot of members of the community attend. And when our son was going to turn 1 year old, I looked in the community. There were two women primarily who made it. And my profession is as a Six Sigma Master Black Belt. So I figure most things are a process. And so I figured I'll try to make this. I'm a good cook, so I know my way around ingredients, kitchen, things like that. So I went down the path of finding recipes online to actually make this and talking to people in the community, in the Ethiopian community, about ingredients, how to source it, and things like that. So I made it for the 1 year, for his 1 year birthday, and elders in the community liked it, family members liked it. And they actually asked me to start making it for their Easter Orthodox. And so I had some left over. I gave it to some people. They liked it. I went to the Wisconsin State Fair that year, 2016, and I saw they had a beer and wine competition. And I started saying, well, a lot of people in the community like it. What would professional judges like? And Ethiopian Tej is made from water, honey, and gesho. Gesho is a bush that's only grown in Ethiopia. And so that's what separates it from just a pure mead. And traditionally, well, most people now just make it with the wood. But a long time ago, they used to make it with the leaves also. So I made a batch with the leaves, a batch with the wood, and a combination batch. And I entered those three into the 2017 Wisconsin State Fair. And I won first, second, third, and best of show.
Wow. Well, there you go.
That's proof of concept right there.
Yes, that's proof of concept. And so from there, various people asked me to make it for them. And, of course, you can't sell it. So, I didn't sell it. But most recently, last year, even a charity golf tournament leadership asked me to make some to actually give in the gift bags for various members. A few Ethiopian restaurants have asked me to make it for them. And that what started me on the path of actually getting the federal licenses, permits, and I'm actually going through the process now of getting the state permit so we can actually sell it to them.
Wow. So you're on the verge of going pro.
Yes, yes. And actually, at this conference, I actually just attended on one of the sessions I was talking about. So you want to take it from being a homebrew to a pro. So it was actually I'm glad I came to the conference. The presenter was very good. I even asked a question about going from homebrew to more of a winery, a brewery, and as far as the ingredients, the taste difference and things like that. So I'm very happy about this conference. I'm very glad that I came to it.
So how do you source your ingredients?
Oh, that's a secret. I will give a plug to Brunda. There's a company inside Oakland, California, that you can actually go online. And I mean, they have a store in Oakland, but you can actually go online and order from them and Amazon. So they're actually a place I use in the beginning, but my current source is secret.
So I think that we've done pardon me, this is maybe the 801st episode of the podcast, so my memory is a little foggy, but I've done it. It seems like I've talked about Tej on the show before, but it's been a long time. Describe the character of the drink.
Okay, so since the drink is made with just water, honey, and gesho, which is this bush, using the wood and leaves from it. So it is going to have a slight earthy taste. The type of honey that you use, well, the type of honey that I use is orange blossom, which is more of a candied honey to cut through and reduce some of the earthiness taste of it and give it more of that sweet, enjoyable taste versus just more of a traditional earthy, musty kind of taste that some people say they don't like. And in all actuality, when I first tasted Tej, that earthy, musty taste, hints of vanilla, when I tasted that, I actually said, there's something nice underneath this, and I wanted to figure out how to actually get past that earthiness. And so my filtering process is different than the traditional process, and my use of orange blossom honey to actually make it more sweet, more candied, gives it a refreshing, sweet, enjoyable, pleasurable taste.
So how are the ingredients added, and do you use heat in the process at all?
You do not have to use heat in the process. There are some people who would heat up the honey only to, so it's more meldable inside the musk. But I don't use any heating process. It is more so of the water, honey first, just mixing it up and then taking a gravity reading so I know the maximum alcohol percent that can come out of it. But then after a few days, adding the gesho. I actually use a open fermentation process the first few days, and then after the third day, go to closed. For a couple of years during the pandemic, I went to where I get my wine supplies. This is 2020, and I was asking them, because I was looking on YouTube, and I saw that people actually closed the lid in the beginning, and I asked the people at the winery about it, and they was like, yeah. You know, actually, if they closed it in the beginning, they was like, yes. And I was like, I've never closed it in the beginning. I said, I've always left it open those first 3 days. And that was my introduction to, that's open fermentation. which I interestingly found out that a lot of people don't like doing it that way because they like to control the air, the bacteria, different things that can actually get into it. So for 2 years, I tried out the, you know, closing it from the beginning. And I noticed it loses some of the character to the point now that from now on, I only do open fermentation.
Wow. So you think that it's, I mean, I assume that you use commercial yeast primary fermenting. But so do you think that there are some, you know, microflora in your environment that are coming in and contributing to the character?
Yes, and that's an interesting point. As far as commercial yeast, I only use maybe your pinky fingernail size of a commercial yeast. It's actually the bacteria from the wood and leaves that actually makes the yeast that will ferment it. So the wood and leaves makes the yeast that will convert it, and it also imparts flavor to it. So it is as minimal as possible of a commercial yeast that you add into it.
Huh. Now, you know, my instinct is to think that, you know, if you used a process something like that, you would get something that's kind of funky or, you know, wild tasting. But it doesn't sound like that's the primary character.
No, it's not a funky or wild taste. You really get the gesso wood, you know, the wood flavor. And so, therefore, that's also important, the tannins and stuff for your mouthfeel. But I've been able to get consistent tasting batches from this process. So maybe it's now, I don't sit it outside, right? Right. That would be probably too much bacteria. So I would say, so I brew it at my home. I have a designated area for it. And so no wild funky taste, no outside air hitting it. Very enjoyable. I wish I had a sample here for you.
One more technical question, then I want to toss over to Steve for his questions. But what about yeast nutrients?
Yes. inside the Learn For, like I said, I've been doing this for 6 years. 2022, January of this year, is the first year I ever started using yeast nutrients. It's actually doing the day 1, 2, 3, you know, after 24 hours, 48, 72. So now I add the yeast nutrients, but think about it, for up to 6 years, I never had to use it.
Huh. Your turn, Steve.
Well, I was just curious about the, if you could talk a little bit about the ABV that you get and shoot for, and then just the mouthfeel, the general, just the overall experience of drinking it. I've never had it. Okay. I am a mead maker, okay, and so have some, not expertise, that's the wrong word.
You do.
experience. So I kind of know where you're headed, but this is a new thing to me, and I'm just really curious about that.
Okay, so as far as the mouthfeel, as I said, from the wood and the leaves, you're going to get some of the tannins in it. So when you talk about flavor profile, and I'm thinking about the different remarks or feedback I've received from competitions, inside of it, if you go through the they talk about the different, you know, beginning, middle, end. So therefore, there's the complexity in it. So it doesn't, the way I make it, it's not just one-dimensional. You know, I think the tannins is what's adding, you know, when you talk about the puckering feel, it's not, definitely not as puckering as a red wine, but it does add, you know, when you're talking about the sharps, you know, so therefore you do have some of the puckering, but not that you're like, oh, this is a strong red. And then I would say, when you talk about lessons learned and different things like this, tartaric acid, is something that one of the judges, you know, recommended. I tried that. I'm not going to do that again.
just trying to add some balance to it.
Yes, and so that's the thing. So one judge was saying that, you know, maybe I need to add some acid to. I still got second in that. And inside that one, that's a drunk monk competition in 2022. And so 2022 is the first year that I've ever added anything different. And but as far as the mouthfeel, to go back to your question, so you know, when they talk about the hints and the taste, and that's why, you know, when I said the vanilla, you know, the guy was like, oh, I taste the hints of the vanilla green tea, I guess because of the leaves, you know, they're saying that they taste the green tea, but they usually say it has a long finish, you know, so they like that. As far as alcohol content, I shoot for actually for 11%, you know, anywhere between 9 to 11. So by taking my gravity readings in the beginning, you know, and end, so that's what I shoot for. So they do talk about the warmth of the warmth of the alcohol feel in it. So I think they like it.
Then do you do anything to preserve the Tej afterwards? In other words, adding potassium nitrate? I've lost my words. Potassium metabisulfite and the other one.
Stabilizers. Yeah. Just go for the small words.
I really had an old man moment there.
Yes. So the potassium metabisulfite, sulfate, yes. So I add that. Then I wait 24 hours before I add the sorbate. And so, yeah, so that's actually for long-term aging. Right. That's what I use for stabilizing aging. Yes.
Nice. Well, it's a fascinating story. Do you have a name for your Tej or your company that people can look for?
Yes. My wife's first name is Senait, S-E-N-A-I-T, and her mother calls her Senu, S-E-N-U. And so I call it Senu Tej. And actually, the website actually go live on August 13th because we're going through the process of getting the state approvals, permits. The website is barkerhoneywine.com.
Well, excellent. Well, the best of luck, and it's a pleasure. I love the conference because of chance meetings like this. We just sat over here because there were empty chairs, and here we are, and we found one of the most fascinating stories of the conference so far. So thank you for sharing your time and your story.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Julie Herz, Executive Director of the American Homebrewers Association, congratulations on your first in-person HomebrewCon.
I know. Feels very good. Thank you, James.
Yeah, it's so good to be back in touch with people, you know, face to face and talking to Steve and I were just discovering stories. You know, we start a conversation with somebody and I say, wait, let me turn on the microphone because, you know, I got to capture this. It's part of the energy that makes HomebrewCon so wonderful every time.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, a national gathering should be annual, and this is a beautiful thing to come back since 2019 when we were in Providence, Rhode Island. Now here in Pittsburgh, going strong, the energy for me is homebrewing is got lots of what's hot talks, what is innovation going on. People are beginners in advance, learning from each other, and it's a great gathering.
Now it's a smaller it's a more intimate gathering than we're used to. You know, people are probably still a little more cautious about, you know, getting out, but you have safety protocols in place. We did the clear thing, and so, you know, there's some confidence in that. we're being either heckled or praised.
Yeah. We seem very excited about basic brewing, yes.
But it's so good to see people out in person again.
It really is. I mean, the country's open for business. Pennsylvania's open for business. The American Homebrewers Association is open for business. Join us. Become a member. And to get traveling again, to have beers in person. You know, I mean, we're going to have club night tomorrow night. Club night's going to be 45-plus clubs that have come from all over the country to impress each other, serve their beers that they proudly homebrewed. Yeah, you cannot beat in person. It is time. It feels good. Many people are cautious about their travel nowadays. I'm just grateful for the ones that have taken that trust and given us a chance to be their conference.
Talk about the educational opportunities. You know, how many classes, how many people are talking and sharing their wisdom?
Sure. So for this year, 2022 HomebrewCon, we have 45-plus talks. There was almost 100 applications for those talks. We have a competition subcommittee on the membership level that vets those talks. The talks I attended today, everything from beginning homebrewing to what's up with your enzymes to how to become a professional brewer, were as varied as possible with, frankly, world-class speakers. We just did day one main stage with Keith Villa, Dr. Keith Villa, and of Syria Beverages. And, you know, the content will continue to unfold for the next 2 days. And then at the end of Saturday's sessions and talks, we will then have not only Bill Kovaleski as our closing day three speaker. He is the co-founder of Victory Brewing Company. But then we will do the National Homebrew Competition Awards, and they will also be streamed via Brewing Network. And those awards will give away more than 45 categories of beer that have been judged on site during this conference for 3 days from 95 judges. So we've got a lot going on all at once. Seminars, Homebrew Expo and Social Club, evening events, and then kick it all off and tie it up in a nice little bow with the National Homebrew Competition Awards at the end.
And what about next year?
Next year, we just announced minutes ago that we will be in San Diego at the Town and Country, June 22nd to 24th. Can't wait. Very, very excited.
Yeah. Steve, you can chime in. I think that's one of our, if not our favorite venue, and we've been there twice for Homebrew Con, but that is a cool, almost kind of retro, but very flexible.
They're redoing it. We'll see what you have to say, Steve, but they've updated it since we've been there.
Well, yeah, it's one of my favorite venues, and when you announced it, I was like, woohoo! You know, when you said Town and Country, I already knew it was in San Diego.
Right, you're saying Town and Country, but you get it. Yeah. You get it. We're all like, yay, that's where we have the best parties, and it's yes. pool and fun yeah. and sun and that. Yeah. It's like a campus.
Yeah,
and club night was outside, and I think maybe pro night was outside, and
I think it was.
And the weather's perfect, and the area itself is wonderful as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
For beer.
Yep. So really, you know, moving forward after a few interruptions, not having hosted the conference since 2019, and not just coming here to Pittsburgh to unfold this, but then to be able to say full steam ahead for 2023.
Well, congratulations again. It's good to see you in person. It's good to be here in person, and we'll look forward to next time.
Thanks for all you both do on Basic Brewing. I've been a listener for many, many years. Good brewing to you all at home, and join us at the American Homebrewers Association. We'd love you to be a member. Membership pays for itself. We'll give you great reasons to brew world-class beer.
Well, thanks again to Julie Herz and everybody else who talked to us on that first day. And by the way, Levon says his Sinew Tej won second place for specialty meads at the homebrew competition. So congratulations and good luck on future professional endeavors. Also, if you want to hear that full episode on Tej, look for the November 12th, 2020 show with Bruce Handley in the archives at basicbrewingradio.com. All 800 previous shows are available for free in the archives or in your podcasting app. And also the video episodes are on the site as well. Even shows that are too old for me to be for me to have posted them on YouTube. So check that out at basicbrewingvideo.com. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.